We're very pleased to have as our guest speaker today Tom Spencer, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Austin Area Interreligious Ministries. Tom has also been a producer and host at KLRU Public Television for about 27 years, and you may have seen him as the host of the Central Texas Gardener on that station.
Good morning. We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion.
To seek truth and to heal our world.
And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this.
A place for questions more profound than answers.
Vulnerability more powerful than strength.
And peace that can pass all understanding.
It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. We stand at the threshold of a narrow gate, a gate through which we cannot pass while burdened by our anxieties and fears. We ask the Spirit that has guided us to this place to grant us a few moments of stillness and the chance to shed our worries. As we enter into this place of deep knowing, a place where we feel the web of connection that binds all of creation, we pray that we are granted the strength we will need to shoulder our burdens once again. Grant us now the wisdom and the courage to listen, to breathe in peace, and to breathe out our gratitude. We thank you for the chance to step through this narrow gate. May we remember that we are never alone, for every step we take has been smoothed by the efforts of those who preceded us, just as we, in our own perfect way, try to ease the way for those who will follow. We pray that in the days ahead, we will not forget this place, the place where we are reminded to be content with what we have and to rejoice in the way things are, where we realize there is nothing lacking, and the whole world belongs to us just as we belong to it. Well, once again, good morning, everybody, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I want to start by letting you know a little bit about how I came to the talking points I'll be sharing with you today, this speech. I was asked several weeks ago, about a month ago, to give a talk to a group of business leaders. This was just a couple of days before the inauguration of President Obama. Doesn't that feel good to say? I like saying that President Obama at podiums. But I was asked to give a speech, and I knew the audience would be people, leaders of the business community, leaders of public institutions, and I thought that they would be feeling some of the weight of the moment, some of the uncertainty of these times, the fear and anxiety that is permeating the country. But they would also share that sense of hope that so many of us were feeling. And these really are tremendously remarkable times, if you think about it. The country has gone through a profound transformation. We don't know what will lie ahead of us, but we know that these times, these days, our actions in them matter. Matter perhaps more than at any time in history. I was listening to the Reinhold Niebuhr, nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime. Therefore, we are saved by hope. But what is hope? How do we know our hopes are real, not foolish wishes? When we face times like these, we better be sure. We better take a sober look at that word, hope. What is it? Is it a verb? Is it something you do? Is it a warm feeling inside? We need to understand, if we are hopeful, what is it that we hope for? And are our hopes true? Before I begin with my dissertation on hope, I wanted to let you know why I'm standing in front of you today. And a lot of people in the past year have asked me, why did you go to AIM from KLRU? You had the best gig in the city. I continue to believe I have the best gig in the city, but let me share a little bit with you about the path that has led me to this place and why I'm going to be talking to you today about real hope. About 17 years ago, as a producer at KLRU, I was responsible for our public affairs programming. I did this for my entire career at KLRU, but at this particular point in time, we were doing a very intensive series of town meetings focusing on youth. Now, I want to let you know that at this point in my life, I thought I had finished the spirituality section of my book, my library at home, and I had completed the books that I needed to read, and I was very satisfied with being a quasi. I liked the description in your song. I think it kind of pegged me to a certain extent. I was a Buddhist, ex-Catholic, kind of interested in, you know, paganism kind of guy. Very comfortable with where I was. As I said, that shelf of books was done. But here I was one day in the KLRU studios, producing yet another town hall meeting. And this was part of a series we were doing on issues affecting kids in the city. And at this point, we were doing a town meeting every night. It was a very intensive effort, and we brought together people who were service providers and the people who were parents and from distressed neighborhoods. And every night, we did a program focusing on things like violence directed at youth, violent youths, teenage pregnancy, failures in schools, addiction in teenagers. And I remember one evening, I had something happened when I was in the studio that really changed my life and is why I'm standing here today. I was listening to all these very earnest, very good people talk about the problem of the day. I can't even remember what the issue that night was, to spin the wheel on issues affecting American youth, and it was something like that. And I started having a conversation in my head, which, by the way, is not a good thing to do on your own live television. But the conversation in my head went like this. Tom, these are really good people, and everything they're doing is important. But they don't get it. This whole issue is much bigger than everything, the accumulation of all these good acts in the room. So I said to myself, you're so smart. What is it they don't get? And the answer really disturbed me. It really disturbed me. I said, there is a spiritual crisis at the root of this. It's a spiritual breakdown. We're talking about the most basic link, the most basic link in human experience, that of one generation and the hope for the next. That link being broken. And I had no other way to describe what caused that breakdown except to say, this is a spiritual crisis. And that really bugged me, and it made me uncomfortable. Because, again, I thought that was done. You know, I'd read my books. You know, I'd moved on to other more important things. And I couldn't shake it. I really couldn't shake it. I went home, and I worried about this, and I thought about this. And I determined that I had been very, very smug and lazy in terms of being a citizen of this country. That I had not challenged myself. I had not thought deeply about what the issues facing our society. And it led me to do a period of really intense exploration, intellectual exploration, about the roots of American democracy, which led me, started by looking at politics, because it seemed to me that that was the realm in which action needed to happen. And it does. It absolutely does. But as I was reading a lot of these books, I came to realize that so much of democracy and Western thought actually came out of the Enlightenment, which was informed, of course, by Christianity and the Judeo-Christian ethic. And I started finding people who, intellectuals who I really admired and was in awe of, who were writing seriously about religion. And I thought, maybe I need to take this a little more seriously. I had rejected so much of the Christian story based on my Catholic upbringing. And I have to say, there's a lot of beauty in Catholicism. There's a lot of things that I still feel very a great pull, an attraction to in Catholicism. I went to Catholic school. I envisioned being a priest when I was a young man. But about the time I was 15, like so many others of my generation, I rebelled against it all. But here I was feeling the pull back into this once again. And I wanted to share with you some of the people I met on those early morning reading sessions when I was giving myself that graduate seminar in American political, then theological history, who've made a tremendous difference to me and have helped me understand what real hope is and how can we identify that in our lives at this critical juncture. And how do we respond to hope? How do we respond to it? It's not enough to hope, to have hope. Sure, it's important, but how do we respond to it is the question we are called on. The first person I'd like to share with you, and there's some of these quotes are in your inserts, and I invite you just to take them home. They're rather lengthy. They come from some pretty weighty things. This is not like the 10-step program on hope, okay? But the first one is from Paul Tillich. And this comes, Paul Tillich, one of the great theologians from the United States in the 20th century, taught at Union Theological in New York City, along with Reinhold Niebuhr, who I'll be quoting later. Tillich, in his last years, wrote an incredibly gorgeous sermon and on the subject of true hope. And I particularly like this, and I think you'll understand why, because of the gardening metaphor in this. But it comes to the point where you have to say, okay, what is real hope and what are foolish wishes? How do we discern what is real? Listen to Tillich. There are many things and events in which we can see a reason for genuine hope, namely the seed-like presence of that which is hoped for. In the seed of a tree, stem and leaves are already present, and this gives us the right to sow the seed and hope for fruit. We have no assurance that it will develop, but our hope is genuine. There is a presence, a beginning of what is hoped for. And so it is with a child and our hope for his maturing. We hope because maturing has already begun, but we don't know how far it will go. We hope for fulfillment of our work, often against hope, because it is already in us as a driving vision and force. We hope for a lasting love because we feel the power of this love present, but is a hope, not a certainty. Later in that same sermon, there's this beautiful short sentence. Out of what we truly are, the hope for what we may become must grow. Out of what we truly are, the hope for what we may become must grow. So who are we at this turning point in history? Who are we? Really? Are we sheep to be herded? Are we fearful? Do we believe in democracy? Do we believe in our shared lives? Do we believe there is a future for our children and grandchildren? Or have we lost that? Are we truly hopeless? Do a moment of assessment here. Out of what we truly are, the hope for what we may become must grow. I would submit to you that because of where you are this morning, there is still a small flame inside each and every one of us, seed-like though it may be, that truly believes and knows the deep web of connection that binds us, the dependence on that web, and the necessity now for change and action. I believe we can see real hope just by our presence in the room today, our willingness to spend a few moments grappling with these issues. So Tillich helps us figure out what's real, what's genuine and about hope. I want to turn to another friend that I encountered in those. I probably spent several years getting up every morning around 4:45, and I would wait until 7 o'clock before doing anything but reading. And I read a lot of really intense books. I loved this. It was one of the happiest times of my life. It was a very intense time. And there were often some very intense books. And one of them, I'll use a quote from Christopher Lash in a moment. But it's a book called The True and Only Heaven by Christopher Lash. And it's a critique of the progressive movement in the United States. Lash was most famous for his book, The Culture of Narcissism, which I'm sure a few of you have read. But The True and Only Heaven really takes American progressives to task. He basically, his premise is, we have elevated this belief in progress being inevitable into a godlike, sacred stature. But his belief was, there's nothing inevitable. History proves things do come undone. Just look at the times. You have to forgive me, allergies. Things come undone. Do we need further proof for that? I believe not. In his book on critiquing the progressive movement, Lash introduced me to Reinhold Niebuhr. He introduced him in the context of the civil rights movement. Many of us remember that. We lived it. Martin Luther King wrote his doctoral dissertation on Reinhold Niebuhr. And Lash made these connections for me. The great strength of the early civil rights movement, the thing that really sustained it, was this amazing strength that came from the Southern Black Church. The hope, the faith, the discipline. And one of those disciplines is something that Niebuhr identified as the spiritual discipline against resentment. This is something that made a tremendous difference to Dr. King, and he wrote about this. The guys with the bullwhips and the fire hoses and the police dogs needed redemption and God's forgiveness, but so did the people who are in the picket lines and at the lunch counters and in the buses. You had to contain your own resentment against the other, lest you become that same person. You objectify that person. Dr. King knew this. It was one of the great strengths of the early civil rights movement, and in my opinion, was one of the reasons why the civil rights movement unraveled into resentment politics. When we became this culture of complaint and everybody was looking to out-complain each other, everybody's persecuted now. You know, talk to the evangelical Christians in their tens of millions. They're oppressed. Everybody's trying to be oppressed. We've lacked that spiritual discipline against resentment. So Lash introduced me to Niebuhr. And Niebuhr has an interesting influence on our times in that President Obama claims him as being the most important philosopher in his life, the one who's helped shape his worldview more than any other. Wow, we ought to pay a little bit of attention to that. Just maybe. The thing that makes me most hopeful about that is Niebuhr was a strong, tough guy with a realistic theology. Looking the world dead in the eye. There's no happy la-la land in Reinhold Niebuhr talk. He believed in ultimate judgment as well as ultimate forgiveness. So, listen to Niebuhr, and then think about President Obama. Let man stand at any point in human history, even in a society which has realized his present dreams of justice, and if he surveys the human problem profoundly, he will see that every perfection which he has achieved points beyond itself to a greater perfection, and that this greater perfection throws light upon his sins and imperfections. Let's stop there for a moment. A lot of us don't like that. We don't like hearing about sins. All right. We're perfect and perfectible, aren't we? So much of our, quote, religion these days makes us want to believe that. And we don't want to hear about sin. Forget that. Where do we fall short? Isn't that the original meaning of the word sin? To fall short? He will feel in that tension between what is and what ought to be the very glory of life. And he will come to know that the perfection which eludes him is not only a human possibility and impossibility, but a divine fact. These paradoxes are in the spirit of great religion. The mystery of life is comprehended in meaning, though no human statement of that meaning can fully resolve the mystery. The tragedy of life is recognized, but faith pervades tragedy from being pure tragedy. Perplexity remains, but there's no perplexity unto despair. Evil is neither accepted as inevitable nor regarded as proof of the meaninglessness of life. Gratitude and contrition are mingled, which means that life is both appreciated and challenged. To such a faith, the generations are bound to return after they've pursued the mirages in the desert to which they are tempted from time to time by illusions of the particular era. Think about President Obama and these words. The tragedy of life is recognized, but there is no tragedy unto despair. That inauguration speech, it was a Reinhold Niebuhr sermon. Perplexity remains, but there's no perplexity unto despair. Evil is neither accepted as inevitable or is regarded as proof of the meaninglessness of life. Gratitude and contrition are mingled. This is powerful stuff. This is challenging stuff. This is the glory of life, to Niebuhr, is in our efforts. The challenge that we take on, the burdens we bear for that next generation, that's the glory of life, according to this philosophy. Are we going to shoulder those burdens? We know we'll never achieve perfection, but we are called to try. If you can see glory in the challenge, then you'll feel like I do today, hopeful, really hopeful, because I feel determined in my heart to make a difference, and I know there are other people out there in the world that do, and I encounter them every single day through my work at AIM. Every single day. We're out there. We're not alone. We're not alone. And we can and we make a difference because we must make a difference now. It's been interesting to watch the debate in Washington since Obama's become president. You notice how hard they're trying to turn it into the same old game once again, right? To drag him down, to drag hope down. We can't let that happen. Getting back to that Niebuhr thing, we will be judged. We will be judged. Now, you may have a different concept than Niebuhr. He was thinking the judge in the sky. It's hard to really realize what Niebuhr was thinking about that. He may have been thinking metaphorically. We're going to be judged by history. Remember George Bush saying, history? We'll all be dead. No, George. No. What about your kids? So we're called to act. We're challenged. I want to finish with a couple of things. You know, we, so much when we think about spirituality or religion or our lives, it's hard for us not to feel we're on a big stage. That these are really profound things. But one thing I learned from my years of studying Buddhism is that it's all about the little stuff. The little things, the day in, day out kind of things. And I think there's a lot of resonance of that in these hard 20th century philosophies that I'm talking about. I'm going to come back around to Christopher Lasch, who I have tremendous admiration for. After he wrote The Culture of Narcissism, and it became a bestseller, he wrote an afterwards in the second or third edition, I believe, and it just kind of thoughts on this phenomenon he had touched off. You know, public intellectuals, their public realm is typically classrooms. When it breaks out of the classroom and becomes a phenomenon in the nation at large, and somebody like Christopher Lasch sells a million books, they usually write an afterword, like, wow, what happened? And and then afterwards, he published to The Culture of Narcissism. He had a very sobering assessment of the needs of the nation at that particular time, and I think it rings true even more today. And I'm going to share with you a quote that I've used often when I talk to people who feel like their hopes are dashed. In my career at KLRU, one of the great blessings of it was I was able to work with university students for 27 years. And sometimes they come to me, I try to be a mentor as well as a teacher. And then often I play the role of advisor. A lot of these kids would be upset. Their vision of their television careers was not working out for them. it wasn't as glorious as they thought it would be. There's a lot more mundane stuff to do. Where's the fun? When do I get to be on air with you? They wanted to skip all the hard parts, right? And I would try to make them realize that you have to take a certain joy in, again, using a Niebuhrian phrase, the joy of life. The great joy of life is in these small things. And I would often share with them this paragraph. The best defenses against the terrors of existence are the homely comforts of love, work, and family life, which connect us to a world that is independent of our wishes, yet responsive to our needs. there's a dot, dot, dot there. There's a very rich quote about Freud that I edit out just for edit. It's really good. But responsive to our needs, independent of our wishes. We don't get everything we want in life. We never will. But doesn't life feed us? Aren't we fed? If we are open to being fed, we can be fed at any moment in our lives. Responsive to our needs. Love and work enable each of us to explore a small corner of the world and come to accept it on its own terms. But our society tends to devalue small comforts or else expect too much of them. Our standards of creative, meaningful work are too exalted to survive disappointment. Our ideal of true romance puts an impossible burden on personal relationships. We demand too much of life, too little of ourselves. We demand too much of life, too little of ourselves. Judgment in history. One of the theologies that makes the most sense to me these days, and I'm very attracted to, was generated by a gentleman who lives about five blocks from here. His name is Michael Benedict. You may have heard of God is the Good We Do, his book. If not, I recommend it incredibly highly. It's one of the best books of theology I've ever read. UT professor of architecture, believe it or not. Michael's book, it's a well-thought-out theology. And his claim is that God is no more than the result of a good deed. God is dependent on us, on mankind, for his, her very existence. Without a good deed, no God. It's an incredibly compelling book. I really challenge you to read that. And there's a beautiful passage in it. Michael, he lives in my neighborhood, so maybe it resonates with me more than anything else. He writes about sitting in his yard, listening and observing all the good deeds unfold around him. A car driving on at speed limit. Imagine that. Somebody stopping at a stop sign. Music drifting from a window in the neighbor's home. Family talking to each other. You know, the safety and comfort that we take for granted in so many of our lives are the result of countless millions of deeds that have preceded us. Michael says that the real wonder, the real miracle of creation is not the fact that there are a billion universes. And if you read the New York Times this morning, there are probably 100 billion Earth-like planets in this galaxy alone. All this mind-blowing physics, he calls that all, that's like screensavers. He said the real miracle is that there's goodness at all. That people find each other. We try, imperfectly, to do good by each other. As I read Michael's account of his yard and all the little accumulated goodnesses, I got the sense that it was like an archaeological feel, that he was standing on this accumulated pile of good deeds. And you can go digging, and you could excavate, and you'd find the simple things, the little acts of compassion, that moment when somebody forgave you, was patient with you, encouraged you. We're all standing on those. It's like we're standing on hills. Each and every single one of us on a little hill. The question we now face, are we going to be building that hill higher? Or are we going to be stuffing the sand beneath us into our back pockets and cowering in trenches? This is the time, more than any time in our lifetimes, when we will be judged. Michael, at the beginning of his book, has a series of poems. I'm going to read a brief excerpt as a prayer out of the sermon. calls these declarations. This is, I think you'll understand why I like this one too. Tell your children that they matter to you, that they matter to others, that they matter to every living thing that feels their touch. Teach them that they have a sacred and ancient mission to turn sun and rain into seed and flower, to turn foe into friend and harm into harmlessness. Teach them that God is not the oldest and strongest force in the universe, but the youngest and weakest one, not a storm, but a breeze, not expended in might, but persistent in direction, not anywhere on a throne, but everywhere in a choice. Send them to read all things about God, that they may hear God's praises in every land and love Him. But bid them remember this: God is the good they do. God is in their hands too. God is in your hands as well. Amen. We leave this sacred time together. Our world needs us and the spirit that we carry forth.
Let us